From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author David Bell, whose new suspense novel is Somebody's Daughter, which is just out from Berkeley Books. David Bell is a best-selling and award-winning author whose work has been translated into multiple foreign languages. He's currently an associate professor of English at Western Kentucky University in Bowling Green, Kentucky, where he directs the MFA program. He received an MA in creative writing from Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and a PhD in American literature and creative writing from the University of Cincinnati. His novels include Bring Her Home, Since She Went Away, Somebody I Used to Know, The Forgotten Girl, Never Come Back, The Hiding Place, and Cemetery Girl. Here's a little information about Somebody's Daughter. When Michael Frazier's ex-wife Erica unexpectedly shows up on his doorstep, she drops a bombshell that threatens to rip his family apart. Her 10-year-old daughter is missing, and Michael is the father. Unsure whether this is the truth, but unwilling to leave the girl's fate to chance, Michael has no choice but to follow the elusive trail of the child he has always wanted, but never knew he had. After Michael departs, his wife, Angela, learns shocking news about Erica and fears for the safety of both her husband and the endangered girl. When a stranger, a man who claims a connection to Erica and her missing daughter, knocks on the door, Angela is drawn out into the night and deep into the tangled web of Michael's past. Over the course of one night, lies that span a decade come bubbling to the surface, putting Michael, his wife, and his whole family in jeopardy. And as the window for the little girl's safe return closes, Michael will have to decide who can be trusted and who is hiding the truth. Somebody's Daughter begins with the sentence, "The doorbell rang shortly after 8 o'clock." So I began by asking David Bell to talk about the beginnings of novels and how he works to come up with a good opening. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I spend a fair amount of time thinking of that first sentence, that first paragraph, because it is so essential. If you think about it, we live in a world in which there are an infinite number of entertainment options for people. People can watch many, many TV shows. They can watch YouTube clips. They can read infinite content on the internet and on social media. So writers who are writing books are really competing against a lot of stuff.
Right.
So the sooner that a writer can hook a reader, the better it is, because a lot of readers, and look, I'm like this as a reader sometimes, I'll start to read a book. If the first page or two don't really get me that excited, I might put the book aside for a while and not go back to it. So I think it's really essential that a writer hooks the reader as fast as possible, that you introduce the characters and the point of view and the setting as soon as possible, so that the reader can then devote their attention to the actual story.
Now, I'm curious, did you write that opening at the beginning of your first draft, or did you go back and change your opening after you had a full manuscript?
You know, the truth is I don't remember.
Okay.
but if I had to guess, I think it was probably pretty much there when I wrote the first draft, because sitting down and writing the first page and writing the first line is one of those daunting experiences, I think, for a writer. I probably wrote a lot of different first lines that I deleted until I felt like I had one right. Once that first sentence and that first paragraph and first page are down, then it feels a little like the floodgates open, and now it's okay. Once you get the right first step, then everything else kind of falls into place.
So I was curious, as you worked, did you find yourself most closely identifying with Michael?
Well, I identified with all of the characters to some extent. But yeah, I understand certain things about Michael. You know, he has been through this experience of having the starter marriage,
right.
And not seeing the ex-wife for a number of years. And I had that experience. I had a starter marriage in my 20s, and then I've gone on and I've now been married for 20 years very happily the second time. But so that whole experience was kind of part of the jumping off point in the book, to say, what's it like if you think you've left something from your past far behind, and then the past suddenly shows up on your doorstep and says, surprise, you have not left me behind. You're not as disconnected from your past as you thought you were.
Right.
Now, I'll just say, to be clear, my ex-wife has never shown up on my doorstep and said that we fought. That's not true. But my doorbell doesn't work. When we bought the house, the doorbell doesn't work, and we never got it fixed. So I don't know who comes to the door. So that was kind of the starting point. And so, yeah, in that way, I understand that part of Michael, that idea that you want to try to think you've left the past behind, but we can't always do that.
Right. And so I should clarify that Michael is one of your many points of view in this novel. And he's sort of the first point of view that we encounter. And so I wondered if maybe that's why. That's why my question was, did you identify closely with him? But we also hear from the third person close narrative of Angela, which is his present wife, and Erica, his first wife. And also you offer us the narrative perspective of a policewoman, Griffin. And I was interested in why you decided to include Griffin's perspective. Can you talk a little bit about that, and also just about writing multiple points of view?
Well, Griffin is in there. First of all, she was a little bit of a surprise because when I made the outline of the book and sat down to start writing the book, I did not know she was going to be a point of view character.
Right.
But I think she's an interesting character because she's the point of view character who is not in the family, who is not tied up in the relationships that these people have had. So she's an outsider. An outside perspective on this family and these dynamics.
Right.
She's a police officer, so she's supposed to be objective and detached and you know, looking at evidence and just looking at facts. But like anybody, parts of her personal life kind of bleed into her job. She's been through a divorce. She's had a miscarriage. And so she's thinking a lot about family and children and that kind of stuff. So she kind of came alive on the page as a character once she started talking and once we started learning things about her past. So I just thought she was interesting. And she could, because she was a cop, she could reveal and learn things and go places that other characters in the book couldn't go and do because
right.
She's a police officer and she found herself in the middle of a number of messes that she got into.
Yeah.
In terms of writing multiple points of view, I enjoy that. I think it's a great way to write a thriller because, say in this book in particular, every character has a secret, and every character knows something that other characters don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So the reader will spend time with one character and they'll learn something. Then they'll jump to the next character and you'll realize, oh, she doesn't know what he knows, but he doesn't know what she knows. And so you can really build tension that way by going back and forth and making the reader wonder, at what point are they going to cross? At what point are they going to share all the information that they have? And that happens near the end of the book when all the puzzle pieces come together.
It was interesting to me that very early in the book, I'm pretty sure toward the end of the first chapter, but maybe it was the third, I don't know, but anyway, Michael makes the decision to tell his wife something. That is, his ex has just arrived and it has told him that her daughter is missing, and she's also told him, big surprise, this daughter is your child, biologically, that he never knew he had. And so he's wondering if that's true. But then before he leaves with her in order to try to help her find her child, he considers whether or not to tell his wife Angela what she has just told him. And it's this great moment. You write, Michael considered telling her something else, leaving out the most damning and painful part of what Erica had told him on the porch. But he couldn't lie to her. He just couldn't. So he told her. And that was so interesting to me because the book's tension could have been ramped up either way. Like, we knew the truth of what she had just disclosed to him, whether or not that's the truth or not, but we knew what she had just disclosed to him. He could either tell her and upset her because they're trying to have a baby and that's not been going well, or he could keep it from her, and that would also create tension. So that was really interesting for me that you had this choice of two different roads of tension, and that's what you chose to do. Do you remember, did you already know ahead of time what you were going to do before you wrote it?
I probably didn't, but what's interesting about writing a thriller is that we tend to think that if you're writing a thriller or a suspense novel, then the goal should be to withhold information or to keep secrets repressed as long as possible. And a lot of times that's true, but sometimes revealing information, sometimes one character revealing a secret to another character can increase the tension even more, and you might get more bang for your buck by revealing a piece of information like this, like Michael telling Angela what's really going on, because that's going to then affect Angela's behavior as she goes through the rest of the night.
Right.
Also, you know, it reveals something about the character. He felt like he couldn't lie to his wife. He had this choice of not telling her something, but I think that says something about their relationship that when given that choice, he basically said, I can't lie to her. I can't withhold something this important from her. Right. So that says something about the way he feels about her and their relationship.
Yep. Now, that brings me to another question I had, which is I thought that this book did a really good job of managing tension in a relationship. And I don't mean a failing relationship or a bad relationship. I just think tension exists in marriage. All marriages have conflict. Not all books depict it very well. But I thought that you really did a good job of showing us what Michael's going through, what Angela's going through, and how they come into, you know, moments of difficulty. Do you want to talk a little bit about writing conflict?
You're absolutely right that even good marriages, even healthy relationships, have conflict and have difficulties.
Right.
And I think it's really hard. I think it can be hard to write about people having a adult grown-up relationship that's not about falling in love or falling out of love or having something like that. This is just like people trying to endure and survive their lives. But I think that's a conflict that maybe more people can relate to because people are in relationships of all kinds, but people who are in good, solid relationships still know every day there's something you have to deal with, whether it's, you know, money problems or kid problems or work problems or whatever, and you have to try to get through those together. And so I think that's what's going on with Michael and Angela, is how does this marriage stay on solid footing despite the craziness that's getting thrown at them?
Yeah. David, I wonder if we can talk for a minute about your writing process. How do you start a novel? What do you know ahead of time when you start, and how much will you allow your vision to stray as you work?
I try to know as much as I possibly can. I make a pretty detailed outline. Actually, it goes through several steps. The first step is just coming up with one or two sentences to summarize the book before I've written anything. Just like can I boil this down to one or two sentences? Then I write a little longer summary of the book, like something that would appear on the back of a book, just maybe three paragraphs, just to say to myself, does this sound compelling? If this went on the back of a book, would people want to pick it up? And then I write a long outline, which can be anywhere from, some of them have been 8 or 9 pages. Some of them have been 20, 22 pages for a book. So a pretty detailed outline where I think I know everything that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And in a way, I think of that long outline as the first draft, in a way, because I'm trying to answer all the questions. I'm trying to know, does all of this work? Does it make sense if somebody does this and somebody does that? And I do all that before I sit down and write the first draft. Then inevitably, when I'm actually writing the book, and I'm following that outline to the best of my ability, but inevitably, as I'm writing the book, something will come up that will surprise me. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, this is better. It's better if the character does this. It's better if the character does that. And the good thing about that is, what's exciting about that to me is, I think if I'm surprised, if I thought I knew what was going to happen in the book, and then all of a sudden some surprise occurred to me and I go in a different direction, then that's going to be surprising to the reader. The reader's going to have the same experience that I've had. Yeah. So I don't have a problem wandering from the outline from time to time, as long as things don't get too crazy and too far away from it. But I think that allowing myself to have that flexibility is always a good thing.
And then how about putting words on paper? Are you somebody who will just sort of like let it all go and not edit yourself as you work and get a first draft down and then revise? Or do you tend to kind of fix things as you go and make everything perfect before you'll move on?
More than anything, I like just getting the first draft finished as fast as possible. So I don't go back and do a lot of editing as I go. I'll do a little. I mean, if I sit down to write one day, I'll go back and look at the previous chapter or the previous pages and smooth some things over. But more than anything else, I'm eager to get the first draft finished for a couple of reasons. One is that I feel like until the first draft is finished, it's almost impossible to know what all the problems are. So once the first draft is finished, then you can look at the whole thing and say, okay, there's a problem at the beginning, there's a problem at the middle, whatever. I also operate out of this unreasonable fear that someone is going to call me on the phone and say, I know the book is due, you know, in May, but we need it 3 months early. And so I like the security of having, and by the way, that has never happened and that will never happen, but it just shows my own insanity, I guess. But I like the security of having the first draft. Like, because I think, what if someone out of the blue said, we need that? Then I can say, okay, well, I've got the first draft finished. I've got it done. That is a great comfort to me to have that finished, because then I feel like, sure, it requires a lot of revising, but like I said, once that's finished, then it's easier to revise and see the big picture. And that's just the way my mind operates.
Okay, that's great. That's very interesting to hear how people work. Now, you already sort of mentioned this, and I have a question about it. You do this great job of layering story scene by scene to increase interest and make the reader want to read on. I think this isn't uncommon in thrillers, but for some reason in your book, I noticed it particularly strongly. So for example, Angela and Michael are having trouble conceiving a child. I think we know that even before Erica shows up claiming that her missing child, Felicity, is Michael's biological child. And then we learn he lost a sister to an accident when she was little. And then we learn that Felicity's picture looks like that child. And I won't go too much farther, but you know, you are really good at layering complications so that further information is elucidated by those complications, if that makes sense. I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about structuring plot to build suspense and interest.
I think it's probably true of any book, but in particular in a thriller, I feel like everything needs to connect in some way. So like you're saying, layering one emotion on top of another is just going to increase the pressure on the character. So Michael has this series of problems. His sister died when he was little, and he feels some responsibility for her death. He's not able to conceive a child with his wife. And then there's a child who may be his who he doesn't know about. And he thinks at times in the book, if this child really is mine, I missed the first 10 years of her life. Mm-hmm. That's 10 years of not spending time with her, 10 years of not supporting her and not doing whatever with her. So all of those things connect, as you pointed out, and all of those things ratchet up the psychological tension on Michael. So to me, it's just a way to find those pressure points on the character that all connect. And so in this way, Michael is, there's a lot of pressure on Michael in terms of family and children and family connections, and that's really what a lot of is about in the book. So I think anything an author can do to continue to exert pressure on a character is going to make the book better. It's kind of cruel. I mean, it's a way you can be cruel to someone who is not real. If you were doing this in real life to someone, if you were thinking like, well, what psychological wound can I pick on this person? You would be a horrible person if you did that.
Right.
But fictionally, you can do it to fictional characters, and it's okay. You're not a psychopath and a sadist or whatever, because that's what you're supposed to do to fictional characters.
Right. You've just brought to mind for me the Jim Carrey movie, the Truman Show. Remember that movie? And they really are making him miserable.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and he's supposed to be a real person in the movie. Yeah, that mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. So you can, if you're a fiction writer or a filmmaker or whatever, you can treat these characters like they're lab rats or you know, whatever, and do whatever you want to them and see what effect it has on them.
Right. Now, Somebody's Daughter all unfolds mostly in one night. The action of the plot mostly unfolds all in one night. So I was wondering why you decided to give it this temporal structure, and what challenges did this create for you?
So if you're trying to write a thriller or write a suspense novel, the key thing is, how do you make it as urgent as possible? How do you raise the stakes as much as possible? How do you make it feel like the characters are racing against time, you know, with a literal and metaphorical ticking clock in the background? And so for this book, I just literally did that. I said, this is all going to happen in one night with a missing child out in the darkness. And what could be higher stakes than that? Is a missing child at night and a bunch of people trying to find her. So this was just to compress the time period as much as possible. Each chapter or each section, each point of view character has the time stamped on the book, so you can just see how much time is passing. The challenge for that is, and with three point of view characters, the challenge was making sure that I could keep track of where everybody was at which time, and that if they were, you know, if one character is moving from one side of town to another while another character is going from one house to another, that they're doing it in the proper amount of time, you know, that you don't have somebody who is off the clock, right, you know, mm-hmm. in some way. So I had to just keep track of where all these people were at which time. It was kind of like a game of Jenga, right, that like I had to have all the pieces together, and if one piece was in the wrong place, then everything fell apart. So that was really a challenge, especially with revising, was to go back and make sure the times made sense and people were moving at the right pace and in the right place and all that.
Yeah. So how do you keep organized? What do you have, like, index cards all over the wall, or how do you do that?
I write a lot of handwritten notes in a notebook, mm-hmm. and my handwriting is terrible, so I have to be careful that I can go back and read my note. My handwriting gets worse and worse every day that goes by. But I just try to write those notes and try to remember, you know, if I see a problem like, okay, so-and-so's not moving fast enough, or where is so-and-so at this moment, I will write it down, and so I'll have all these messy handwritten notes around on my desk, and then I, especially in the process of revising, I will go through and try to say, you know, okay, today I'm going to solve this problem that I realize. The problem with writing any book is that when you solve one problem, it might create another problem. You know, it's like, you know, again, it's like the Jenga metaphor. You know, you fix one thing, but then something else is now out of whack,
right?
Which can just drive writers nuts. I mean, those are the times when I say, why am I doing this exactly? Why am I playing this weird game of Jenga? But eventually you get to the point where enough of it has been fixed and enough questions have been answered that the book is standing on its own.
Great. Now, I may have missed something, but I was wondering, do you ever specifically name the state that this is all taking place in? Or did you, I know that you name like the county and certain towns, but did you intend for it to be somewhat universal, or is there a state named?
It's supposed to be taking place in Kentucky, where I live.
Okay.
I don't remember if I ever actually say the word Kentucky. I think I do in passing, and I think I make reference to cities like Louisville and things like that. I think it's in there, but really I do want it to be as universal as possible, because obviously I want the story to appeal to a lot of different readers. And I don't want people to get too hung up on saying, oh, this is a, you know, this is a Kentucky story, or this is a Southern story, or this is a whatever story. I'm just not a writer who uses the geography or the place as much in the story. The towns that the story takes place in are made up,
okay,
so that I can do whatever I want with the geography and the setting. So that if I want to have the police station be a certain distance from the park, or if I want someone's house to back up to a cornfield or whatever, I can do that and then feel free to do whatever I want to do within that setting.
Okay, that's great. That makes sense. excuse me, David, I wonder if we can talk a little bit about your publishing journey. I understand, of course, this is not by far your first book, but I just wondered, you know, I think people who are writers really enjoy hearing about how a person originally got published and what their journey has been. Like, are you still with the same agent you started with? Have you always published with the same publisher? Things like that.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird publishing journey, but maybe everybody's publishing journey is weird when you get right down to it.
Yeah.
I published two books with a small press before I was published by Berkeley Penguin.
Mm-hmm.
So the very first book I published was with a small press, and when I wrote that book, I got a blurb from a writer, a mystery writer named Ed Gorman, who passed away last year, but was truly an amazing guy, a truly amazing writer, who, if there was any justice in the world, would have been a bestseller every time out, and been living in a mansion and whatever. But he was a guy who helped a lot of writers, and so I got a blurb from Ed Gorman for that book, and then, I don't know, maybe a year, 6 months after that book came out, Ed had been in touch with an editor at a publishing house in New York and said, this editor is looking for new writers, and I mentioned you to him. So he put me in touch with this editor.
Nice.
And yeah, I know. It's like, I mean, what? It's crazy. So he put me in touch with this editor, and we talked about story ideas and whatever, and that was when I wrote Cemetery Girl.
Okay.
And this editor wanted to publish Cemetery Girl at his house, but when he was interested, then I was able to go and approach agents and say, hey, I've got this editor. And I did not have an agent at the time.
Okay.
But I was able to go to agents and say, hey, I've got this editor interested, and I desperately need an agent to take care of business for me, because I don't know what the hell I'm doing in New York publishing, right? It would be like if I went out and tried to buy a house without a real estate agent. I would have no idea what I was doing.
Yeah.
So that was how I met my agent. And then the book ended up getting sold to Berkeley instead of this other publisher. And so since then, since Cemetery Girl, this is the eighth book with Berkeley, and I've been with the same agent and the same editor the whole time.
Oh,
and
wonderful.
So it's all worked out very well since then.
Okay, that's great. Now, you are presently on a book tour, is that correct, for Somebody's Daughter?
Yes, just starting, but yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So What is your book tour like? What is it like being on book tour? And do you have to do a lot of your own marketing, or to what extent do you take that on?
I think that the author has to share a fair amount of the responsibility for publicity and marketing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just think that's the way the world is mm-hmm. right now. And publishing is that because of social media, it's an opportunity for an author more than ever to communicate directly with readers and to directly tell readers, this is what I'm doing, this is what's going on. I think readers are interested now or have an expectation now that they're going to learn more about a writer than just this person writes books. You know, because of social media, you can sit there and say, you know, here's a picture of my cat, or here's a picture of my desk, or, you know, here's the movie I saw this weekend, or you know, it's my wife and I had an anniversary, whatever. So there's an opportunity to show a different side of yourself to readers so that they feel like maybe they're getting to know the whole person, to whatever extent anyone shows their whole selves on social media. Sure. But that's something that I think writers have to carry a certain amount of the load on. But there's really no way for anybody to do it alone, because the people in the publishing house, the publicists and the marketing people and the social media people and the sales people, they have so many more contacts, they have so much more knowledge of the business that they do their share of the heavy lifting too. So I think it has to be a collaborative team effort to get the word out about a book and about an author, and that's probably what works best.
Okay.
In terms of being out on a book tour, it's fun because writing on a daily basis is obviously a lonely, solitary business. You know, you're sitting in a room, usually by yourself, imagining people who are not real, and if you're talking, you're probably talking to yourself, you know, repeating dialogue out loud, and you probably, if somebody came walking by and looked in the window, they'd think, what's wrong with that person who's talking to no one? So that's a very isolated experience. It's not like being, you know, an actor on stage or like you're in a band and every time you write a chapter, somebody gets up and applauds for you. I mean, you're just you write a chapter and you're like, oh, okay, I wrote a chapter. I guess I can go drink a Coke now or whatever. And that's the biggest reward you get in that sense.
Yeah.
So going out on a tour and like meeting readers and having people say, I liked your book, or asking questions or getting a book signed, that is a big thrill because it's the kind of feedback you just don't really get at any other time on a daily basis. So to me, that's why I enjoy doing it.
Okay. All right. Great. We just have a few minutes left, so I want to ask you a couple more questions really quickly. First, I'm wondering if you've read anything, if you've read anything lately that you might recommend to listeners, a book that you've read that you've enjoyed.
Yeah. In terms of thrillers or suspense novels, I've read some good ones. Jessica Strasser has a book out called Not That I Could Tell, which I think is excellent. Kimberly Bell with an E on the end. We're not related. So I'm not giving a plug for my cousin or whatever. Kimberly Bell with an E on the end, just released a book called 3 Days Missing, which I got to read an early copy of, and that's really excellent. Very surprising thriller, big twist at the end that you won't see coming. So that's very good. There are a lot of really reliable, well-known thriller writers like J.T. Ellison, Lisa Unger, people like that, who I just think you can't go wrong if you read people like that. And then I'll throw out the book from the past that I just recently read was War and Remembrance, which was Herman Woke, who wrote The Winds of War and then The War and Remembrance. I read that. It's a massive 1,300-page book about World War II, and that's amazing. And I think Herman Woke is a great author. He's 103 years old and still alive. So anyway, I've just that's just something I read over the summer because I had a lot of time to read.
Okay, fantastic. So you mentioned dialogue about 5 minutes ago, and I think you do dialogue really well. And I wonder if we can close with your offering some advice for listeners on writing dialogue.
I think dialogue is tough because you have to make it sound the way people really speak without writing it the way people really speak.
Right.
Because
yes.
the way we speak is a mess. I mean, if you looked at a transcript of the way we talk, you know, there are all these digressions and grammar errors and incomplete sentences and fragments and wandering thoughts and ums and uhs and all that kind of stuff. And you can't put that in a book or it would look kind of idiotic.
Right.
But you still want to convey that the speech sounds natural in a book. So that's kind of the tightrope that I think writers have to walk with dialogue. And really what I said before of sometimes reading it out loud, is I think a key. Does it sound like this is what someone would say? I think dialogue is a great way to build tension in a story because, say, someone asks another character a question and the character doesn't answer the question directly, you can start to see that maybe there's a problem there. Maybe there's some tension building. Why is this person not answering the question directly? Why are they changing the subject? And then, of course, another big part of dialogue are the gestures and the actions that go along with the dialogue.
Right.
And so there can be as much power in either what is conveyed through gesture or through what is not said that can do as much to move a story along as what is actually said by the character.
That's fantastic. That's a great answer. I just want to finish by saying the name of the book again, which is Somebody's Daughter, published by Berkeley, written by David Bell. David, thank you so much for your time today. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And that was an interview with the author David Bell. We discussed his new novel, Somebody's Daughter, which is published by Berkeley. You can learn more about his work at davidbellnovels.com. So this week's Write the Book prompt has to do with part of the conversation you just heard with David Bell. We discussed writing conflict and the fact that even the best relationships are likely to have some conflict. Often when we read conflict in books, it's the massive blow up that might come at the end of the book. But some conflict is just centering on regular everyday problems between regular people. As David said during our interview, these might be money problems or kid problems or work problems. Sometimes marriage is just about getting through those kinds of daily issues together. And that's the case too with workplace conflicts or friendships, other relationships. So this week, write a scene of small conflict, daily conflict, normal conflict, something that might occur in any marriage or relationship, even a healthy one. Consider what causes the interaction, what each person's position is, why those positions might be at odds, even if the ultimate goals are perhaps the same. So for example, maybe two parents are concerned about a child's lack of interest in school. Maybe mom wants the daughter to get a tutor and really focus in on homework. And the father feels that the daughter needs more extracurricular activities. Both agree that they want her to be happier and more successful at school. Both have her best interests in mind, but they argue over the best approach. So what small issues might crop up to cause a disagreement in your scene? And then while you're writing it, you're probably going to be including some dialogue. So keep the dialogue moving, keep the dialogue real. But as David Bell said in our conversation, also you don't want the dialogue to have the sort of digressions that we have in our regular life, in real life. So, for example, the fact that I'm saying and I'm having a little trouble finishing my sentence here, you wouldn't put that into every single scene of dialogue. So, you know, keep it moving, keep it real, but don't make it completely real. Take out the ums. Okay, and don't forget to describe the scene as it would look to your narrator in the moment. So, good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. So if you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, please let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like Write the Book, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all of your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.